Just to give us a fine point, because this is so crucial, what we're discussing. And I discuss it at considerable length in my book because people are so ignorant of history. We are not the Belgians in the Congo. We're not the Dutch in Indonesia. Okay? We're not the British in South Africa. We had been there all the time. We had been in the Congo. We had been, if you will, the equivalent in Indonesia. We were kicked out of the Congo and nothing happened in the Congo. Nothing. No other people there, no development, nothing.
We might not be hearing a word you're saying, Matt, but I know you're very enthusiastic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome.
Matt's still celebrating. Happy belated birthday, Matt.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm 34 now.
Hell yeah.
As we discussed, past my prime athletically. but it's good to be back with you.
Matt was at the Nets game last night, suited up, just hoping they give him pass him the rock.
Well, not last night. It was a Friday night. I could Celtics game a little bit too steep a price for me even on my birthday. But I did see the Raptors play.
Actually, we usually don't pull chat things up, but I did notice this, and I think you might have a long lost cousin in Australia. The dude in the round of 16 with his game winners named Matthew Lecky.
That's funny.
we got a big one for everyone tonight. I mean. We're always honored to be joined by our friend Kurt Hackbarth, who is here. I mean, we've done a couple of these before with him where we take New York Times articles and we look at the way that they're presenting things. This one might be the worst one we've seen, in my estimation. Like, really duplicitous misinformation coming out of this New York Times article about Mexico. And we go through it, we break the whole thing down line by line just to show not only why this is wrong in this particular case, but like how to read these kind of pieces in general. Because these are the kind of weasel words, certain types of framing that really obscure the truth and allow big outlets like that to publish disinformation. That has massive effects on politics in the world.
I mean, it's just a really good exercise to close read these articles off. I mean, Hitchens used to do this often. Actually, Russell Brand was somebody who used to often just take like articles up on stage and go line by line. And closely reading things, you can see where things that are supposed to be just statement of fact and, you know, New York Times, all the news that's fit to print. There's a lot of very like kind of obvious choices to sort of imply nefarious doings by, you know, folks who aren't full partners with the United States.
No, and absolutely. And then we're going to be joined by Benjamin Case, who's a postdoctoral candidate at a postdoctoral member at ASU, Arizona State University, who joined us to talk about ballot initiatives. I mean, we talked about this a lot in the aftermath of the most recent midterm elections, but they put together a really great study at ASU looking at ballot initiatives, what the kind of prognosis is for utilizing those to get us through this kind of democratic deadlock. You know, you can put questions to people when we talk about on this program all the time. Sometimes this red state, blue state divide really obscures the commonality in the American working class when it comes to a lot of these issues, from things like abortion to things like higher minimum wage, protections for working people, taxes on the rich. So he joined us to sort of break that down, show some of the strategies, some of the pitfalls of that. And I'm really excited to share that with all of y'all later. And reminder, all of the links and things like that for both of our guests are in the chat if you want to do some further research or reading after the fact.
Absolutely.
And before we get to our main story, Matt, I mean, do you just want to – we might come – give a second preview towards the end of the show, but do you want to tell folks what that cold open was about to remind folks they should be joining us at patreon.com/leftreckoning for the post game immediately after the show?
Yeah. So that was Benjamin Netanyahu, the former and soon to be once again, leader, prime minister of Israel, with our boy, Jordan Peterson. He went on the Jordan Peterson podcast to have a free and a fair exchange of ideas in terms of like, I mean, a pretty interesting conversation of that. I mean, if you know anything about American history and the certain types of justifications that were used to exterminate and dispossess Native Americans because basically they weren't doing anything with the land. Basically, that's where Netanyahu comes down on, simultaneously saying that the folks who were in Palestine before Israel's colonization project didn't build anything or only built one city. So, you know, who cares? And so pretty gross stuff. And it's interesting to me just because, and we'll get into this more in the post game, but of all the ideas to get floated on the dark web, the intellectual dark web with all these guys, not one of them ever really pro-Palestine. In fact, unanimously, to the extent they'll comment on it, pro-Israel. And actually maybe the thing that the elites don't want you to know is that Israel has the right to defend itself.
And before we get to our opening segment, Matt, I do just want to let people know that we've gotten some pretty dark news out of Argentina, where courts have decided that Kirchner, the current vice president of the country, has been sentenced to 6 years in prison and barred from running for political office in the future. And we're working right now to try to get somebody on to sort of help break down the entirety of that story. So we're not going to be able to do that tonight. But just like we've seen throughout South America in recent years, lawfare has been a very, very favorite tactic of the right wing when they can't win elections. And the entire legal proceedings against Kirchner have been marred with some pretty significant scandals, most notably of leaked Telegram messages that sort of show that there was some coordination between business and wealthy interests in the country and the people who were running the prosecution in Argentina. So we'll definitely be covering that in the future. And I just want to make sure that our listeners, you know, have that on their radar as well, because it's a pretty significant development in that country that has been in the crosshairs of like global finance capital for the past few years in particular, but throughout the last few decades, as that country is one that has been a kind of poster child for what the international financial system will do to any kind of country that tries to start looking out for their people, even in the most moderate, sensible, and simple ways.
Yeah, we've probably been due for an Argentine expert since the assassination attempt, at least on Kirchner.
Totally. So we'll get that to y'all soon. But man, before we get to Kurt and talking about the New York Times and all that kind of stuff, Matt, I mean, it's still in my head. I'm not over it. I'm still mad, and I don't want this thing to get buried in the news cycle, because we just lived through a pretty significant moment, I think, in American labor history, with both the House and the Senate overwhelmingly following Biden's orders to deny workers their right to strike and to fight for a better contract. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot. So it's one of those things where it's just like, what else do we want to say? Becomes difficult. I mean, if I were to put a top line, I think the most important thing for our audience and just folks in general to recognize is that this kind of alternative universe that is trying to be created by a lot of members of the media, by a lot of pundits out here, that the story is, the mean Republicans all got together and denied workers paid sick leave. It's absolutely bogus. The president of the United States of America, Joe Biden, decided that he did not think that rail workers deserve the same rights as other workers in this country, and took significant action to deny them that right. He asked Congress to support him in that, and they did. All the other stuff at this point is very clearly theater. And I think people should not accept this kind of false framing of this issue as like, oh, the Republicans in the House, put up an opposition to paid sick leave. Oh, the Republicans in the Senate put up an opposition to paid sick leave. No doubt. That's their role. That's what they do. The Democrats were the ones who put this on the table, mm-hmm. right? So if you're sitting here saying like, oh, the Republicans at the last minute fucked everything up, you are confused and being lied to.
Yeah,
it's very clear what happened here.
I can't get over that this entire time the railroad execs were like, yeah, we're pretty sure. We're okay.
Yeah.
I think that's like the number one thing. And with like whether it's a revolving hero or not, I'm at least glad that Tlaib did go out and show what the right position was. Mm-hmm. Otherwise it like the, what you have from the rest of the squad is, obfuscation. And it's the type that is a problem in and of its own, irrespective of the railroad workers getting fucked. Mm-hmm. It's a problem when you basically see that these folks, and I would call them like leaders, and above all, like we can admit, like better than average Congress people, okay? But when they're willing to when they're given the opportunity to have an out and say, mm-hmm. actually, my contact union leader X gives me an out to, and it actually says it's okay that I voted to remove these folks' ability to strike from them using state power, that doesn't fly. And mm-hmm. Tlaib had the right choice, right? And honestly, it wasn't just Tlaib too. And that's the other amazing thing is Peltola and a whole bunch of other Democrats were able to have this right position. And the thing is like, just put it on the hat of like, okay, let's defend them trying to play the game. Like Ilhan came on Majority Report herself and said that we're going to have someone ready to challenge Hakeem Jeffries. Mm. I haven't seen anything about that.
No.
And so like, what are they getting from, playing that? And they need to start coming up with something. It's not going to be sufficient for the vote that they take. Let me be clear about that. Like, I don't think that's a terribly, it's not a forgivable vote. That is as bad a vote as you can take.
It's the worst vote you can take, in my opinion. Yeah. And, you know, look, I'm not going to, I think it's important to be clear about these things that, It's Biden and Democratic Party leadership that's doing this kind of thing. And this is a moment where the progressive members of the House, particularly anyone who has any affiliation with the Democratic Socialists in America, no brainer. Should you not only not vote for denying people their right to strike? And that's the framing we need to remind folks of. It's not just about paid sick leaves. It's a question about whether or not you think that the state should have the ability to deny people their labor rights.
Yep.
And, you know, we saw Ilhan just a couple hours ago talking about corporate profits, you know, in this country, which is truly egregious. There's no doubt about it. And then what happened? What happened with the people in government? You're highlighting this problem. And then what happens when we're talking about this, like heightened corporate profits? Biden and Congress voted to deny workers their right to strike. And unfortunately, significant majority number of the people who are DSA progressives, etc., voted with them. Mm-hmm. They might have, you know, they made some moves. They tried to do something. You could say, you know, that's better than just straight up voting for it. Fine. Mm-hmm. But it's unacceptable on any kind of basic level for them to be doing this, because it's not just about a symbolic vote. It's putting ourselves as leaders in this fight, saying mm-hmm. we do not recognize or do not think that the United States government should have the ability to take away this fundamental right from working people. You can talk about how greedy the railroad corporations are, but if you line up with them in this vote, you know, you don't really have a lot of room to speak on this. And it's, look, there was no scenario that we saw when Biden made the decision that he did, it would, you know, the writing was on the wall. The government was lining up behind corporate power, no doubt about it. Could the quote-unquote squad have been able to block that single-handedly? No, right? You look at the votes, we see. There was a moment in this country where working people were standing up and were fighting and were pushing for something different. And what was the role of the progressives? I'm not even too worried about that as like a denomination, right? It's just, you know, it's wishy-washy. The socialists, the people who say they are democratic socialists, what was their position? Was it pushing forward the ball of class consciousness, class struggle in this country, or was it playing the game? And as you said, Matt, you know, is what you got from it worth it? hard for me.
The only hopeful scenario would be if Biden was like, actually, we need this. And I don't believe this, by the way, but let me just walk through it.
Yeah.
That, come with me on this vote, and then we'll build up pressure for an executive order on this stuff in the future. And to me, it's like, first of all, if they're playing a role like that, they could play it just as well taking the right vote, and then the pressure's even greater on you. So I don't quite like, I feel like that's what they've landed on, but I don't really even buy that logic. It's too clever. And it's too clever because we know what happened. We know it's like simply that they had certain like contacts with union members who said, this is the strategy we want to go with the Biden administration, but like the rank and file were not there. They rejected that crap. So it's like and all of this is, it's basically like, again, like that's the problem with this is it instead of like a very clear moment where everyone can see who, what side everyone is on, we have this massively complex PR game.
And even like, you know, I know you're just playing devil's advocate and you don't believe this, but like, even just like on your theory, let's imagine an alternative universe, right? Where Biden actually had some, you know, backbone and spine and interest.
And didn't just want to come through for them like they expected him to.
Right. But like, Let's just put that on the table for a second and say that, you know, Biden puts in the sick days at the last minute, right?
Yeah.
It's still unacceptable. And It's unacceptable in the sense that this is a question not just about sick days. This is a question not just about a contract. This is a question about the freedom of working people in this country and whether or not they should have that, or if Congress can decide, oh, this is too sticky, this is too disruptive for corporate profits, we're going to scrap this one, you know, work in a different industry and maybe you guys can strike, but if you work in this industry, we're going to say no, right? Yeah. And no person who says that they are a socialist, somebody who says working people in this society are stepped on and create the vast majority of wealth and value here. They are the people who run the system. They are the people who put food on the table. They're the people who keep the lights on, and they deserve to have power over themselves and their lives and the society. That is what it means to be a socialist, is to say it is wrong that the people who do all the work are the people who have the least power in the society. And if you are somebody who has that as a commitment, as an idea, you cannot take the position that we are going to deny people that ability to play that role. That's it. Yeah. There's the political pundit thing, but like, how can we get this or that outcome from this kind of thing? And then there's the fundamental moral question of, do you fundamentally believe that working people have the right and the ability and the capacity to rule over their lives, or do they not? And you make a decision like this, you might've wanted a nicer version of servitude for working people, but it's very different. From the radical liberation perspective that is the socialist cause and the socialist movement. And it is fundamentally out of step here. And it's just, I get heated because it is just such a tremendously dark moment, I think. It's worse than a loss. You know what I mean? Like, it would be one thing to lose a vote like this, but to see a moment where this question was brought in front of the American public, this fight was happening, and to see people who say that they're in this movement, that they're in this fight, be incapable of being able to make the basic kind of right decision on that is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly demoralizing.
Yep.
I know before we get to Kurt, we did want to highlight some bravery and some people who have been doing some other things. So I might just start really quick, Matt, something we've been covering on this program since the beginning of this program. I wish that it wasn't the case for them, but our friends in Alabama at Warrior Met, Cole, are in their 20th month of a strike, which far exceeds any kind of typical strike in the American economic system. I mean, from what I've read, something like 6 weeks is typical for a strike like this. 20 months is unbelievable. And, I hope that folks out there are, continuing to follow this story and show support for these folks, because they've been unbelievably brave as everything has been thrown at them by Warrior Met Coal. In Alabama, they continue to say, we are not going to, bow down to these folks. And that's something to take a lot of inspiration. And we have other stories on this. And, we just talked about something that was really upsetting about politicians But what gives me confidence, what gives me hope, what gives me motivation for all this stuff is that while the political scene is so fucked, right? And you get fucked because the people at the top of the system are trying to destroy you. And then the people who, you know, are supposed to be our allies, you know, regularly are incompetent. The ability of working people across this country to continue to say no and to fight even against extreme odds like this is something that's really inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have some other labor, a lot of going on these days. And I know this is actually a story we thought about having a guest on at the New School. This is from Paulo L. Dos Santos, who I believe is an economist at the New School, shares, New School is now threatening to cut medical insurance payments to any and all employees in the UAW strike or respecting its picket line, because nothing says social progress like threatening people's access to health care in the middle of an uptick in COVID-19 cases. And the important thing to stress about that is why, despite all of the arguments that it'd be more efficient using the economy of scale in a national health service, we do this through the employers, is because they want it as a cudgel to coerce your labor in case you might want to, you know, hold out for a little bit more. So disgusting stuff there. I can't remember who was it. Was it John Deere? Who was it that during the Dem primary was going to start? I forget who was on strike, but it got.
There was a John Deere strike. I just don't know what you're talking.
I forget. There was a strike and there was the health was being pulled. The company announced that. And then because Bernie was running and was able to put attention on it, they had to go back on that. But unfortunately, I feel like all this stuff is going to come so hot and heavy that even the fucking New School feels like they can get away with it now.
Yeah. No, the New School stuff is egregious. And you know, we last Thursday we were on talking with the friends at TIR and a gentleman from University of the UC system in California. You know, those strikes have been incredibly inspiring. We're continuing to see people fight back in Starbucks across this country and Chipotle's as well. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of hope. That's the thing is that and honestly, I'll tell you this, Matt. I'd much rather have a tandem, but if I had to pick, I'd much rather have a more rambunctious and militant working class than even a couple of very articulate and passionate Congress people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. you know, I mean, there's a lot going on. I won't get into the Twitter headquarters janitors went on strike and immediately Elon terminated their contract. So I just think, you know, that's something to note from all the people who like to gloat about the fired PMC. Mm. Just not going to mention that one probably. And also, you know, places like BuzzFeed seeing big layoffs, the folks who actually put in it should offend you, even at a place like BuzzFeed, that the people who put in their time and labor just get sent away, which of it, okay, maybe the package is better than in different industries, but fucking venture capitalists get to walk away with all that property to go try to flip it to somebody else. That should offend anybody. I do want to shout out Working People's Podcast. Yes. Max Alvarez, who've had on the show, did a great panel with a bunch of different rail workers, so people should check that out. I'll share that here, and I recommend this, and it is the type of conversations that need to be had, because you know the truth is you can't rely on progressives. Mm. Unfortunately, I think progressives are good, but you can't rely on them, and this is basically a installment in that.
And just talking on that, you know, continuing to show love to our friends at the Real News Network. They're doing their fundraising drive right now. So if you have a couple of extra bucks in the back pocket, you know, try to go there and donate, because, you know, when it comes to these kind of things, the you know, like the rail strike, nobody was covering it as we were going into it, right? It became a big news story, except for you know, a lot of, you know, our friends, for example, Valley Labor Report, people like Jonah Furman, and also the folks at the Real News Network. And you know, you don't get a lot of rich donors showing up knocking on the door with checks when you're writing about working people and the fights that they're in. So more than, you know, anything else right now, I think it's really important to try to show
The Silicon Valley money men who have all your favorite writers writing about trans people being pathological and this or that. They're not going to fund the real news to hear about, you know, conductors being concerned that their shit's getting automated away or attempted to in some sort of, I mean, Elon Musk gets a frankly a bad rap. He is not individually worse than typical guys. He's just like flamboyant about it. Like all these people are as psycho as Elon is. And one final shout out, actually, if you have also if you're doing well, like some of our farmer friends in the audience are locked out workers from Monosol in Indiana. My name is Dustin Roach, and I'm raising money for workers who are locked out by their employer, the Monosol Corporation. For years, the company is understaffed. Let me know if any of this sounds familiar. For years, the understaffed its plant in La Porte, Illinois, forcing their employees to work inhumane amounts of overtime. The company dropped an unacceptable final offer that doesn't end forced overtime, nor does it address the other issues. On 11th, overwhelmingly voted the final offer down. So, yeah, I'll retweet this out. Jonah Furman also tweeted it out, but look out for GoFundMe, these Monosol workers in Indiana.
All right, man. Well, we're going to jump over to Kurt in just 1 second. Just want to remind folks that if you like the work that we do here at Left Reckoning, it means so much to us to support us at patreon.com/Left Reckoning. And look, we give you a little something on the other side. You get the post game where you get to leave us voicemails and DMs, and Matt and I hang out and answer those after the show. Matt's got a really good Jordan B. Peterson and BB Netanyahu segment locked and loaded for the post game tonight. And last
night, if you want to see a guy, sorry to cut you in, but if you want to see a guy just bowled over by the charisma of a politician and basically unwilling to inject any sort of backbone into a conversation, just be a supplicant. Please wash over me, Benjamin Netanyahu. That's Jordan Peterson in his interview.
And if you saw our conversation, Why the Left Loses, looking at Hal Draper's The Anatomy of a Microsect theory reading, that was a bonus episode that we released to the public. We just did a part two to that with The Two Souls of Socialism, which is a really, I think, critical read, looking at, you know, some of the questions. Typically when people talk about divisions in like the socialist movement, the question is almost always, is it reform versus revolution? But Hal Draper, one of the great American Marxists, has a really great essay looking at the history of the socialist movement and says it's not as much that as it is the question of top down versus bottom up socialism. So we break that down, and that's up for patrons already. You get access to that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Much more coming throughout December. I think this would be a really good month when it comes to the stuff that we'll be covering. And check it out. And
For patrons on Sunday, we're having our buddy Akuba of This Is Revolution back, and we'll be going over Tucker Carlson's documentary on tanning your ball sack for masculinity purposes, because I know Akuba has been doing a little bit on how to reach out to young men, and I think, you know, what better person to get. So I'm looking forward to that.
I think it'll be awesome. Well, we're gonna go to Kurt Hackbarth, who's an excellent journalist based in Mexico, to talk about how newspapers lie. I'm really excited to share this with all of y'all, and Matt and I will be back in just a little bit. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined by Matt Leck. And we're thrilled to be joined again by our friend in Mexico, Kurt Hackbarth, who's an excellent journalist based out of Mexico, who's here to help us out break down another New York Times article, because it seems like AMLO is up to his old tricks again, trying to spoil Mexican democracy by doing things that are very popular with the people. Thanks so much, Kurt, for hanging out with us.
Thanks, guys, for having me back on in our recurring segment, The New York Times Tells Me.
Right? I mean, this is actually, we've done a few of these now, but this one is really striking, I think, because there's not a lot said, actually, and I think that some of the implications here are quite nasty once you know the facts, but I think we could just sort of pull this up and we can take a look, because this is not one of those things where we have to cherry pick quotes. You can really go through the whole thing.
The whole thing.
Find some malpractice here. But here's the piece, y'all, in the New York Times. Mexico's president leads supporters in march through Capitol. Tens of thousands of Mexicans walked through the streets Sunday to show their support for President AMLO's President AMLO amid some pushbacks to his political agenda in recent weeks. Kurt, I mean, just for you know, a lot of our listeners who might not be up to date with what's going on in Mexico, I mean, you know, what is the kind of political stage that we're in there, and you know, what led to this march in the first place?
Sure. AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is in the fourth year of his presidency, and was originally scheduled to give an address in the Zócalo of Mexico City on December 1st, which was the day he took power 4 years ago, in a sense to commemorate the victory and give basically kind of a state of the union to the public as to where things are, right? What they then decided to do was to march to the Zócalo. AMLO has a long history of, you know, being in the streets from his years as an opposition politician. When he was an opposition leader in Tabasco back in the 90s, you know, he marched from Tabasco to Mexico City, right? Hundreds and hundreds of miles. Back in the time when, you know, the first opposition victories weren't even being recognized by the then hegemonic PRI, right? Mm. He's got a long history of street activism. And, for example, in 2006, when he was cheated out of his first presidential victory, there was also, you know, a massive march and they occupied the Zócalo. So this kind of harked back to that tradition, but in office. And what I think is quite extraordinary about the march is you see in the picture, despite, you know, the menacing darkened shades they put in it, is a president marching with the people. You know, no security detail, you know, out there with what national media calculated as 1,200,000 people. Right? Mm. At times it's tens of thousands, because they want to make it look like it was the same amount of people who marched in an opposition march 2 weeks before. So they say thousands in the header and then tens of thousands in the, you know, the first paragraph to try to make it seem as if they were the same. Mm. By no objective measure, the two marches were the same. I mean, by no objective measure. The opposition was good. I mean, it was, you know, there were tens of thousands, as it says, but nothing to do with this massive march that showed up to support AMLO, which stretched from Chapultepec Park all the way down Paseo de Reforma and all the way to the Zócalo. I mean, it was just, this is the fourth time that AMLO has gotten more than 1 million people out in a march. And that's historic in and of itself. So the fact that, of course, the numbers are minimized is, you know, the first thing that's designed to throw you off. And that was expected. That's like the least of it. Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting is, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, I was just going to say is that what's funny about it is, like, again, like the sinister tone of, like, how dare, you know, the president walk amongst the people.
Yes.
Thinking of a piece of American media, the West Wing, which a lot of these kind of folks like, there's a very famous scene in it where the President Bartlet gets out of his limo and walks to Congress to get things done. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, like, in the kind of liberal imagination, this is a beautiful thing. And yet when you actually have somebody doing this in a much more populist and with the people way, then that, I mean, it's, again, is treated as something extremely sinister and, you know, something's afoot instead of, you know, a display of popularity for the president of Mexico.
Yeah, it's okay for a TV show, but not for the leader of a Latin American country. The thing is, you know, I was there, I covered the march. It was a very happy, jubilant march. I mean, there were marching bands. There were, you know, there were people on. It was like a festival atmosphere, which is great. Because imagine how difficult it is to get that many people out for something. This wasn't a campaign rally. I mean, you can say, okay, for a campaign or a presidential campaign or something like that. This is simply to commemorate 4 years in office. Mm-hmm. It's a sign of the continuing popularity that he has, you know, despite outlets like the Times and Post that simply hate the fact that he's able to continue to turn people out and march among them, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe we can go through some of these.
Yeah, for sure.
These here. So I'll just read it, and then I've got some things marked. It's really important because we can't all be up on everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the New York Times banks on that in order to basically throw two sets of lies at you, as we were talking about before. Lies of omission, where they just blatantly lie. Or lies of commission, sorry. And then lies of omission, where they leave out necessary context to make mm-hmm. things look sinister, right? So let's go ahead with it. 2 weeks after tens of thousands of Mexicans protested against proposed electoral changes they say would undermine democracy, Mexico's president on Sunday marched through the capital, accompanied by massive crowds and a display of popular support for his mandate. In an early taste of the 2024 presidential election, AMLO's supporters, some traveling hundreds of miles by bus to the capital, came with Mexican flags, marching bands, and even president-shaped stuffed toys as they filled the heart of the capital, chanting, "It's an honor to be with Obrador." Now, next paragraph. Mexico's political opposition and some members of civil society spoke out against the march, calling it a show of force by a leader they cast as a budding authoritarian. Careful. That's the word they're going to try to get into you across the entire article. Resources, including welfare programs, to maintain his popularity. That's the first mention of the word welfare, which obviously in American English is a very loaded term, right? Mm-hmm. It's got a very unfortunately negative connotation. Let's see how many times they use the word welfare over the course of what is a fairly short article, right? That's the first time, right? The president has denied these accusations, but the sway Mr. López Obrador maintains over many Mexicans was on full display Sunday. Some said they were there to show support for a president who had benefited them economically through welfare programs. So that's the word welfare in three paragraphs, right? First, the opposition accuses him of using welfare programs, and now they're saying it right in, you know, the reporting of the article, welfare programs. Although they were less aware of Mr. López Obrador's more specific policy goals, including the contentious electoral changes he hopes to get ratified. So this is a real doozy of a paragraph, because basically the insinuation is the people who attended the march are bought off mm-hmm. by welfare programs, right? We've used the word twice now, welfare, and they are ignorant because they don't know about his other policy goals, like the contentious electoral changes. Now, the piece was written by Steve Fisher and Maria Abi Habib. And, you know, I hope they were out in the march like I was. You know, with over a million people, it's hard to get a scientific sample of how many people there were aware of the electoral changes and how many weren't. Yeah. They were well aware of what the electoral changes were, right? I don't contend that I also talked to a scientific sample of people. But here they're making a blanket assertion. I mean, they always try to weasel out by saying some. Mm-hmm. That are there for welfare, but have no idea about these awful authoritarian changes that AMLO wants to make because they're dumb. The basic idea is that.
And yeah, then like,
yes.
Well, I just want to say a couple of things here because, like, I mean, you know, this really does just show a way that a lot of U.S. media just covers other countries too, right? Like, there is no kind of political agency for these people. They are being bought off effectively by, like, programs that help them, which is, like, you know, for me with my kind of politics, it's like, yeah, that's what politicians should be doing is, like, providing things that make people's lives better. That's how you win power. That's, like, what we're supposed to be doing here. And two, it also, like, it reminds me so much of a lot of like the Democratic Party commentators on like CNN and stuff in the most recent midterm elections in the U.S. Because like in this country, it's been wall to wall Trump stuff. Right. And like there's a certain class of people in this country who are very worked up about it. I don't think that everyone else is not worried about, you know, threats to democracy. But it was one of those things where they were seeing polls and it was like, what was the number one issue for voters? The economy, right? And it's just like, oh, the voters are so stupid. They don't, you know, understand all these things like I do. And it's like, no, I mean, it's very clear that you have a very different different class of position and perspective, where it's like, it doesn't matter for you so much that, you know, gas prices are high, that people are struggling and all this kind of stuff. What matters is this kind of feeling about, like, you know, the sanctity of democracy. And in the Mexican cases we'll get into later, I mean, a lot of these kind of accusations that the system is under threat there are very much overstated. But yeah, I mean, I just wanted to throw that in there as well.
No, that's absolutely right. And on top of all this condescending tone, you know, that, you know, how dare people vote for someone who then fulfills campaign promises and, you know, passes social programs. They then contradict themselves later in the article, right? Because they say first that they're welfare programs, and then they criticize AMLO for giving money where it's not needed because they're actually universal programs. They're not means tested. So they're not even welfare programs, right? As they're understood in American political jargon, they're universal programs like Social Security or Medicare. Anyone at any income is eligible for. You know, and you know, heaven forbid you have universal programs that are general with the public. We have to do complicated means testing, you know, according to the New York Times kind of class, right? So that there's a basic contradiction there to begin with. So the next paragraph then is the overhaul would give the president more control over Mexico's electoral systems. Now, this is just this is a lie. This is a lie of commission. This is just wrong. Mexico has an electoral institute, which has which is run by 11 councilors or members. And what the reform would do is, instead of having the councilors chosen by the lower house of Congress, it would make them subject to popular vote. The people would elect them. That's the thrust of the reform here. All three branches would nominate, I think, 20 candidates each, and you know, the general public would decide. Right? As it stands now, as AMLO's party Morena has a majority in both houses of Congress, the current law gives them enormous power over the councilors. The new councilors are going to be chosen in the spring, and because Morena has a majority, it's going to choose a majority of the councilors under current law. So actually, giving up power, they're giving up the power that they have as the majority party by subjecting the councilors to popular vote. Now, other people have said, oh, well, you know, because people are easily swayed by the president, right? They use the word sway in the too, that, of course, people are going to vote for, you know, the candidates the president wants. Because, again, as you said, David, the Mexican public has no agency. Easily swayed by welfare programs and a messianic leader.
It's all just anti-democratic. I mean, and like that thing of some said they were doing this. It's like you said, some is New York Times speak for the people we want to emphasize for the point we're trying to make.
The people we talk to in Starbucks said that, right? What they're while they were getting their, you know, their frappuccinos.
But like, and this goes back to like the last time or one of the previous times that we had you on to talk about AMLO having a referendum on his presidency, where, you know, they had a vote because, you know, it's a one term system. So this was an opportunity to basically create a check, a precedent of a check on somebody who has a lot of power, the president. And again, this action of saying we should let the people have a voice on to as to whether or not they think we're doing a good job was treated as this really nasty, horrible, authoritarian move. And again, like I have, I went to college and I learned a little bit about authoritarianism in other countries and the history of it. I actually do not remember any case studies in authoritarians asking people for their input as a way to, you know, to undermine democracy. I mean, it's very much the opposite.
Or electing, you know, the counselors of the Electoral Institute, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, part of the reason why the National Electoral Institute is so unpopular as it is now, besides the fact that the councilors currently earn exorbitant salaries, more than the president, even though there's a new law that, you know, nobody in the federal government should be earning more than the president, just enormous waste and extravagant spending, is that they've been very much against these referenda. And they've, you know, dug in their heels and dragged their feet and I've done everything possible to try to make it as difficult as possible for these referenda to happen, which is, again, obviously something that's very anti-democratic. Mm-hmm. So the National Electoral Institute is unpopular. They've earned their own unpopularity. Mm-hmm. Aren't, people aren't dumb. They see that very, very clearly. Now, the next article, the next paragraph says, and here we, things get very sinister, because, of course, we're in Latin America, so all presidents are, you know, authoritarian dictators in waiting. Opposition members worry that the president will try to push through the changes by other means before the end of the year. Mr. López Obrador has used presidential decrees to adopt some of his more contentious policies recently. Okay, now let's pick this apart a little bit. What AMLO is proposing is a constitutional level reform, basically a constitutional amendment. So it requires like in the US, supermajorities in both houses, and then has to go to the state legislatures, just like in the US. Now, if that doesn't pass, fine. He has suggested that he will try to do a more scaled back version by a standard law. You know, you can't do as much because it's not a constitutional level reform with a simple majority, which he has in both houses of Congress because he won the election in 2018 and his party won the midterms in 2021. So when they say by other means, what is that supposed to mean? Mm-hmm. Constitutional amendment doesn't pass, then they will pass a law, which is what you do when you're trying to reform something. You pass a law. So what is this by means? And of course, they don't give you the context to know. What does that mean? Put military out in the streets? What is that? Arrest and kidnap the members of the Electoral Institute? What are they insinuating here? But they don't even give you enough information to know what insinuating. And then they say he has used presidential decrees. Presidential decrees mean executive orders. Exactly what the Democrats are, you know, crying and whining that they want Biden to use all the time. Executive orders. AMLO does it there. Presidential decrees. As if he were governing by decree. To adopt some, here's another that weasel word, some again, of his more contentious policies recently. Like what? Ones.
And contentious to who?
Yeah, contentious to who?
Can I ask you, though, is presidential decrees, is that like a fair translation of what the Spanish word for would be for that? Or is that
the Spanish word? It's a very literal translation. They do.
So what I'm saying is
it has the legal effect of an executive order.
No, but so we can give them that. But in the context of them also using welfare, which is like an Americanized word to suggest universal social programs, right? You know, when you start mix and matching these kind of things, trying to figure out which one has like the most bite to it versus which one sort of explains what's happening. I think that, you know, you can call somebody out on, you know, making an executive decision. That's how they want people to understand.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, welfare is not what the Spanish word is. And there they used a very creative translation. Here, they selectively used a very literal translation because I think it sounds more sinister, right? Mm-hmm. Be consistent.
Yeah.
Right? Right. The next paragraph then says, Sunday's march was a bid by the president to show popular support for his overall mandate, as well as for his bid to overhaul the electoral system and increase his power over the body that oversees voting. Now, this is the same lie they said two paragraphs ago. They said he wanted to have more control over the electoral system and increase his power over the body that oversees voting. And I'm not going to repeat myself, but it's a lie. They've lied once. They're going to lie again. And the point is to repeat it, right? You know, Morena has a majority right now in Congress. They're going to, under the current law, select the new counselors, and they're even going to be able to choose who's the president of the institute, most likely, under current law. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's something they might have wanted to mention, just at least to give some degree of balance to what they're saying. It came 2 weeks after a march to insulate the institute from the changes tens of thousands of supporters. That protest was the biggest opposition march of this presidency. When Mr. López Obrador addressed the crowd Sunday afternoon, his speech focused heavily on the welfare programs his government has introduced. That's the third mention of the word welfare. The third. While mostly skirting the rising violence and worsening security situation that has afflicted the country since he took office in 2018. Of course, the Times, has to throw that in there. Some 4 years into his term, the president maintains an approval rating that hovers around 60%, making him one of the world's more popular leaders, right? Actually, he's the second most popular in the world after Modi of India. Hard to imagine, right? Except if you have a public that is easily swayed and bought off by welfare programs, right? An agency less, right? Love is paid back with love, he said when he took to the stage. That's actually a lovely quote in Spanish that comes from a play by the famous Cuban writer, Jose Martí, Amor con Amor se paga, right? Here, just the way it is, it sounds like something, a messianic leader trying to sway the public would say. Mr. López Obrador cited the austerity spending program his government has produced, which had led to some government workers having to bring in their own toilet paper and drinking water to some state agencies, according to employees. Maybe. Yeah. And my opinion in Mexican federal government offices, there's never really been a lot of toilet paper. And probably in American federal government offices either. drinking water, you can't drink out of the tap anywhere. That's always been a thing. So you have to have bottled water. So I don't really know where they're going with that. I don't know how germane that is to the march, but fine. In our government, he said there is neither luxuries nor waste. Well, actually, yes. I mean, he has cut unnecessary spending in wasteful spending in the federal government to channel it to social programs. I think we can agree that's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah. And just really briefly, because I think sometimes people don't know the history of Mexico. Government employees have lived very well for a long time in that country, which has really been a big reason that there, is this kind of push, this kind of popular push to deal with the waste. Because people always,
that's right.
People always try to compare the austerity of AMLO to a Blairite kind of austerity, there's questions about, in every which case, but what we're talking about here is not as much, coming after social programs, but coming after budgets that we're filtering money to people who have, nice jobs, and get to live in the city in a country that has a significant amount of poverty. Right. So I think, again, these things are important even for our left-wing audience to remember too, that, these phrases sort of invoke a certain imagining of what's happening politically. And sometimes you miss the history of the country as well.
That's very important. Mexico had what has been described as the pharaonic system, where the top level members of the federal bureaucracy lived very high on the hog. In the Peña government, they were, flying around the country in helicopters, they were even going to golf games in helicopters, all kinds of expensive, a fleet of expensive cars for the federal government, any kind of perk and benefit you can imagine. So, that was just a very clear campaign promise by AMLO. Those days are over, and he has cut back on that, and very well he should have. And that's actually one of the complaints with the National Electoral Institute. These counselors earn enormous salaries, and everything else they spend on. I wouldn't even go into the list. But they earn the equivalent of, $10,000 to $15,000 a month, all their perks and benefits and such. While the minimum wage in the country is still around $10 a day. That really sticks in the craw of people, as well it should. So I think that should have been the thrust of the article rather than the toilet paper.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think that's not the most important thing. Now the next paragraph says this is freed up money to direct into the welfare system. Fourth mention of the word welfare. Fourth. Although some independent economists who Say the programs are not as efficiently run as during previous administrations. Oh, yeah. The efficiency of the Peña Nieto government corrupting the world. And hand out assistance regardless of need. Well, actually, that's what universal programs do.
Hand out
programs regardless of need because they're universal. You know? Ross Perot got Social Security until the end of his life, and I'm sure he collected on it. You know? Buffett is, you know, all of them, right? Because they don't let a dime go by. That's what universal programs do, right? And there's a great argument to be made that universal programs are, it's much better than means-tested programs because they're cheaper and easier to administer, and they're more politically popular. Means-tested programs are the ones that are most easily attacked and most easily revoked. So universal programs are better, and then you can use taxation at the higher levels to get the money back from people if you know that's what needs to be done. And of course, it does need to be done. But the phrasing of that, hand out assistance regardless of need. Right?
I mean, it's just, you know, no surprise to, I don't think, anyone watching this, but like this is a very clear example of how, you know, a news article has like a tremendous amount of opinion in it. You know, a wasteful program is one that, you know, is universal when, again, like, you know, and if we're just doing the just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing, I think you're not really presenting that that argument in a neutral way. You are putting it up to make it seem like he's bloating the budget up with these nonsensical programs that are just lining the pockets of who we don't know. But I guess it is the vast majority of Mexican people who are also too stupid to be able to know what is in their interest or not in their interest and are being duped by showing popular support into supporting this. I don't know. Just like,
well, that's really a brilliant summary, actually. That's a brilliant summary. And he's stealing their toilet paper.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, which is the worst of it all. I mean, he's simply a comic book villain. So I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit for questions of time. Three paragraphs ahead, it says, critics of Mr. López Obrador said that he and his government put pressure on Mexico's powerful limbs to attend Sunday's march. Now, this is what the opposition says. What's the proof? It says critics say, you know, this is the he said, she said thing, right? Say one thing, they say another. But there's not really any reporting here to determine whether that assertion is correct or not. It just says critics say that they used pressure on labor unions and accused municipalities governed by the ruling party of pressuring citizens to attend, paying for the buses to transport them to the Capitol. Well, that's what critics say. Is it true, New York Times? Is it true? Tell us. Well, we don't. Because they don't tell us, right?
And it's rich to print this in a country whose president just last week forced union workers to go back to work and accept a deal that they didn't want. You want to talk about pressure?
Absolutely.
You know, this is something. This is pretty rich. Yeah. And also, we don't need to focus on it, but I do just want to highlight this because I found this made me laugh a lot. They interview a gentleman who traveled from Oaxaca to be there in support of the president who, quote, helps the people most in need, right? Somebody who's traveled a long way to support the president. He said he was disappointed with the worsening security situation in his own town, in hometown, that will always exist, he said, right? And, you know, this is going back. It's like there's obviously, you know, not downplaying violence in Mexico. But this is one of those things too, where like these are the kind of like sticking points. It's the same way as like Republicans are saying, though, crime in America is out of control, and like there's a fixation on this kind of narrative. You know, it's also a way to take somebody who, like, I'm just going to take a little bit of privilege here because I think they've been doing this the entire time. So I'm going to assume how this conversation goes on. They interview this person. Hey, why'd you come here? I love AMLO. I'm here to support the president. Oh, well, we need something here. If I bug him about worsening security, and even in that quote, it's not almost failing on this. It's saying this is like an unfortunate reality about the society that I'm living in. And it's put in a kind of way. It's like, oh, once these people are sort of exposed to facts and reasons from these brilliant American journalists, prodding them, then they start to see, oh, maybe there are some problems with AMLO. I promise you that this person, when he was finished with that interview, went right back into the march and continued participating in this show of support. I don't know. It's just like, it's one of those things where they're fishing
very like
big time.
And another point, Oaxaca State was governed until 4 days ago by the opposition, but they don't tell you that either. Oaxaca State was governed by the opposition party. So that might have something to do with the security matter as well. Yeah. Right?
It's true.
The next paragraph after that, where we were, it says, what the march shows is the fear of the president and his administration that is to lose power in the 2024 election, said Claudio X González Guajardo, a member of the political opposition. Now, this is very, very important that they interview X González. Claudio X González not only is a member of the political opposition, he is also the founder of an organization called Mexicans Against Corruption and Impunity that is funded by USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy. Right? So USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, through the organization he founded, and which he collected a very fat salary in until he gave up the presidency of the organization, is funded by the United States government, right? And I think, you know, that's a very important point. And I think it's worth the whole of the program as to what the USAID and what NED is doing abroad in the guise of promoting democracy. Now, Claudia X González also received a front page puff piece in the New York Times in 2017. You can just Google it. It's right there. Because the former Mexico correspondent for the New York Times, Assam Ahmed, was a big buddy of somebody in, I think it was the press secretary, in that organization. So they got the New York Times to publish, just a fawning piece over Claudio X González on the front page of the Times in 2017. So I think all of this is a really big conflict of interest, right? Mm-hmm. Besides the conflict of interest, that the person that they quoted is the founder of an organization financed by U.S. money.
Mm-hmm.
Might be interesting for people to know that, I think.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spoil anything, but let me just make sure I'm not going to make a fool of myself, but I feel pretty confident making this prediction. It doesn't seem like anybody from, AMLO, coalition or aligned with AMLO is interviewed once in this piece too, right? They're the only times we get these quick one-liners from people who are at the event, yeah, which is great and fine. But it is amazing to put a lot of space in here for folks who, as you're saying, are fairly compromised, or there should be a little bit of a disclaimer about their position not have any real room for AMLO. I mean, everything about AMLO is said about him. The only direct thing we get from AMLO is him saying, love will be paid back with love. Again, yeah. Malpractice.
You're right. And meanwhile, the opposition's opinions are mentioned in the third paragraph, then again in the seventh paragraph, then again about five paragraphs more down with the supposed independent economists, mm-hmm, and then again Claudio X González, right? But right, nobody from AMLO's coalition is quoted at all. None, right?
Yeah.
That's par for the course, right? So, and then going a little bit farther down, Mr. González agreed that the president maintained high approval ratings. He pointed to the loss of seats in Congress the ruling party suffered during the elections last year. Yeah, they lost a few seats, but they held control of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Then they talked again about the unions and how the unions went. Oh, the unions. Next paragraph down, and I think this is very important. The opposing marches of recent weeks scored a fractured Mexico. where Mr. Lopez Obrador, over the last decade, has established a political party that has mostly outmaneuvered its opposition. Now, what do they mean by fractured? If you think fractured, you think it's kind of the country is 50-50. Mm-hmm. Really, it's not 50-50. AMLO is the second most popular leader in the world, you know, depending on, you know, we know that it's sometimes hard to compare polls across countries, but he's, you know, universally agreed as being popular. And this march was an order of magnitude larger than the other one, maybe 10 times more. But because they said from the beginning that tens of thousands of people went to each march, that sets up later this idea that maybe Clinton too, it's fractured. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a minority that hates AMLO, but it's a minority. He's popular with the majority. But you know, a fractured country gives the idea of something that's not the case. Now, the next sentence is, I think, the biggest journalistic sin of all here. Mm-hmm. But the ruling party faces major obstacles ahead of the 2024 presidential elections, including a weakening economy. Really? Mexico's economy was scheduled to grow 2.1% in 2022, and that has just been revised upward to 2.5%. We can argue if 2.5% is good, not enough, whatever else, but I find it extraordinarily difficult to say that it's a weakening economy when actually it's strengthening in the second half of this year. Now, this isn't the only time they've said this. Maria Abi-Habib, in a previous article, right, which it says, has Biden's top diplomat in Mexico gone too far, officials ask, which talks about the U.S. ambassador in Mexico, Ken Salazar, went so far as to say that the Mexican economy is cratering. Cratering, she said. Mm-hmm. This was just a few months ago. They said cratering, right? It says, I'm just reading from this other piece. The Mexican economy is cratering, violence continues to rage, and now Mexico, not Central America, has become the biggest source of migrants. This hysterical of cratering. Where does she get that? And this isn't an opinion piece. They said it in the body of the article, cratering. With no not a link, nothing to substantiate that at all.
Some economists say.
Yes. So I called her out on this in Twitter. I said barely 2 months ago, the two of them in the New York Times said the Mexican economy was cratering. The Mexican economy created some 157,000 formal jobs in August, a record for an equivalent month. What does Maria Abi-Habib then say to me? The U.S. created over 500,000 jobs on July, yet economists are largely predicting a recession. And then what I said back to her was, the exact word you used was based on absolutely nothing. The Mexican economy is projected to grow from 1% to 2% this year, and now it's 2.5. But of course, being Mexico, you can simply throw words like that around, right?
Yeah. And I hope you don't mind us being online millennials, Kurt, but there's a pretty good ratio here. Look at this.
Yeah, I think I did all right. I think I did all right on that one. I think 3 to 110. I'll take that.
Yeah. Well, you're cratering. You're cratering. Numbers are down.
I mean, that's a New York Times class thing, though. Like, you see them basically take for granted that we're in a recession now when they talk about these layoffs going on wherever, right? It's mm-hmm. recession time. It's time for us to basically do what we want to do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? And the thing that really gets me is that they will do this across a series of articles, right? Mm-hmm. One who reads the New York Times over the course of several months continues to see references in news pieces, straight news pieces, that the Mexican economy is weak. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that's what they're going to think is happening, right? The Mexican economy may, you know, grow more than the U.S. economy this year. But see, all of this is just designed, just like in the picture at the beginning of the article, to paint a sinister picture, right? Bad economy, worsening violence, authoritarian measures, take over the Electoral Institute, paid off people, welfare, right? Mm-hmm. Gratian.
I mean,
it's just all hot button words, right?
You would imagine. I mean, I would like to see these people reporting on FDR. at that time, you know, he's threatening to destroy the judicial system by saying he's going to pack the courts, doing this or that. You know, somebody who's very beloved, and you know, there's good arguments for some of the good things FDR did. But you know, it just is so amazing, the sinister backing behind it. And I think, you know, if the case is so clear. Right. If the case is so clear, if what you're hearing at nice restaurants in Mexico City is so clear that AMLO is a dictator in waiting, all these things are happening, we're seeing the warning signs now, then be explicit. It's this kind of dancing around language that they're forced to do. The welfare, by other means, right? All of this kind of stuff, some say, to try to paint this picture that something really awful is happening. And by omitting the context of, for example, what's happening with the electoral system there, is that AMLO is actually saying, we're going to bring this more to the people, have it be much more reflective of, you know, popular will, if you want to use a word like that, than the previous system, which has a lot of problems. Instead of, you know, saying that, it's, you know, they're trying to mess around with the elections, right? I don't know. It's just this one, we've done a few of these before, and I think that while they've all had a lot of double speak and stuff, this one is really shocking once you actually get the full understanding of the subject that they're writing about, just how upside down the piece is to like the actual on the ground reality in Mexico today.
And because they have to lie so much, that's exactly why they dance around it, because they can't simply report what's happening. Because it doesn't, you know, line up with their argument. So they have to use all these weasel words and the some say and the independent economists and welfare and such. And here's one more, which is in that next paragraph after the supposed weakening economy. The next paragraph says, Mr. López Obrador is barred by the Constitution from running for a second term, but is thought to be positioning a loyalist from his party as a presidential candidate so that he can maintain influence once he steps down. Mm-hmm. The weasel word here is the use of the passive voice, right? Is thought to be positioning a loyalist from his party. By who? Mm-hmm. Do reporting. Back up your little weaselly allegation. Is thought, right? Any high school English teacher would put a red circle around that, because it's the use of the passive voice to weasel out of something. Mm-hmm. Who that? Just like the independent economists. They don't tell you, right? And the fact that he would support somebody from his own party with the next election is the most natural thing in the world. Who doesn't want somebody from their party to win the next election? What is he supposed to help the opposition win? What the hell does this mean?
That's the thing that's so bizarre. I think you're right to point out the passive voice, but then when you actually get to the allegation, it is truly amazing. Yeah, AMLO's going to put on a political enemy to run the country after that, and no political party in the world functions in that way.
What the hell is this supposed to mean? And this, you know, opposition here in Mexico, because presidents can only serve one term, first they accused AMLO of wanting to reelect himself. And he said, I'm not going to. And then they said, instead of just admitting they were wrong, they said, all right, well, he's going to put somebody else in so he can operate as the power behind the throne. So they're just, the New York Times here, as they tend to do, is just repeating a baseless opposition talking point that they invented to try to cover their ass, because the first thing they had said proved false, that AMLO wants to reelect himself. Mm-hmm. So this other thing that the New York Times repeats with this weaselly passive voice as if it were a fact, right? Mm-hmm. That I think is really bad. And then, well, it just ends with another one of these vox pops that is exactly similar to the one that you'd mentioned earlier in the piece, right? Another person come to the rally because she liked the social programs, but she did not like the security policy of the president, and that she would never hug a criminal, as if the president is suggesting that anyone should hug a criminal, right? And I think that probably went the exact same way of the, you know, of the you had mentioned earlier in the piece. That she came, she came to call her support, and the interviewer probably said, but what do you think about this? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is pretty extreme journalistic malpractice, even for the New York Times. And you know, it's worrying because you know the coverage of Mexico is really sparse in the U.S. In a way that really does boggle my mind sometimes, especially like living in Texas. You know, literally being a neighbor. And, you know, you don't hear very much about Mexican politics in American English news. And when you do get something like this, it becomes even more dangerous for these kind of falsehoods, right? Like when the New York Times puts out a bad piece on like, I don't know, crime in the United States, right? And it has an effect and that's dangerous, but at least there's so many publications and sources and things like that, that people are reading so that they can, you know, maybe piece some things together that there's a problem here. But with this, it's like, the vast majority of people who go are going for international news in this country are going to the New York Times, they're going to the Washington Post, and they're hitting like the America section. And you get these pieces every couple of weeks, and they're very sinister, contain outright falsehoods. You know, it creates a really dangerous situation where, you know, your average American like news consumer has a really warped view of AMLO, which I'm sure is only reinforced you know, by any kind of wealthier expats or things like that, that they can talk to in this country. And yeah, it's a really classic case study in the role of the media, in this country, really, you know, lying to us.
Yeah. And this is built on the fact that there's already so much, you know, misinformation about Mexico and, you know, racist coding, this idea of, you know, the poor immigrants and the idea of the cartels and all the stuff you get on these shows and cartels, this and that, and Netflix, whatever else. So there's all the more responsibility on the part of the journalistic world to go over and against the stereotypes, go over and up against the racism, go over and against the classism and the bad hombres and the rapists tropes. And all of this stuff. There's even a greater responsibility there, and they're doing it even worse. They're doing it. They're actually reinforcing all of this stuff and giving it not a Netflix show, but they're giving it the veneer of the gray lady, which is, you know, everything that's fit to print. They're taking all of these tropes and they're codifying it into the authoritative voice in American journalism. And I think that's much more dangerous, you know, than Trump's crap, than, you know, the stuff you'll see on the shows, the sensationalism and such, because they're presenting us as the straight dope, right? Straight news, the real story. And there's actually no reporting here. There's no investigation of the opposition's claims. There's all this, some say this, some say that, right? You know, there's this playing on this idea that he wants to take over control of the Electoral Institute and continue to run the country behind the throne. All the stuff which are just lies. I mean, those are just straight up lies. And it influences public opinion and influences public policy. So that's why they get public policy wrong.
Yeah. And you can see it in the people that they're talking to. Kurt, I really appreciate you coming on here so much. People, there are links below for you to follow Kurt. If you ever see Kurt's work in fine publications like Jacobin, you should definitely click and you should follow him on Twitter for some really, really good information. I really appreciate you so much. Thanks again.
Thanks, guys. Thanks again.
Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here. Matt's out celebrating his birthday. Hope he's having a good one. But we're very lucky to be joined this afternoon by Benjamin S. Case, who's a postdoctoral scholar at the Center for Work and Democracy at Arizona State. And Ben's here to talk to us a little bit about ballot initiatives. And thank you so much for taking some time today to join us.
Great to be here.
Well, I mean, I really like the recent pieces in Jacobin about ballot initiatives, and we've been talking a lot about them on this program, particularly because of how notable they've been and sort of flipping the script on, I think, a lot of people's conceptions of like what people in quote unquote like red states believe. But before we get into the strategy and the mechanism and all this stuff, as somebody who studies this, I mean, could you sort of highlight some of these sort of, you know, conventionally surprising results that we've seen in ballot initiatives in the past few months to years?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of folks started paying serious attention to ballot initiatives this past summer when Republican legislators in Kansas ran a referendum to enable them to overturn abortion rights. This was hot on the heels of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, and Republicans in Kansas wanted to capitalize on that momentum for the anti-abortion folks. They ran this amendment. It's a Republican-controlled state. It's sponsored by Republicans, and anti-abortion politics are supposed to be a pillar of Republican politics. They got crushed. They lost by almost 60%. And that's, again, a Republican-controlled state. And so I think people started sitting up and saying, wait, something's going on here. Obviously, the pro-abortion folks were celebrating, but also were noticing maybe there's a path here to passing all kinds of policies that maybe we wouldn't think are possible in states like Kansas, right? And then in November, all five initiatives on abortion went for reproductive freedom, right? Three of them were enshrining abortion rights in California, Michigan, and Vermont, and two declined to get rid of abortion rights in Kentucky and Montana. And so, again, we saw the same sort of thing. And this shouldn't be surprising, right? Because for years, polls have showed that a majority of U.S. Americans support abortion rights in some form. But then we have this sort of partisan political rhetoric that tells us that the country is split down the middle, and there's these sort of two sides, and abortion politics are this political third rail that politicians can talk about, but they can't really try to do anything about, certainly not on the enshrining abortion rights side. But ballot initiatives provide this opportunity to translate that popular opinion directly into policy. And it's the same story with other issues in recent years. In the past decade, ballot initiatives have been used to raise minimum wages, expand access to Medicaid, tax the rich to fund public schools and services, like things that should be impossible through legislative politics. Actually succeed a lot of the time through ballot initiatives. So in our research at the Center for Work and Democracy, we cataloged and analyzed every state-level ballot initiative from 2010 to 2020. And we found that initiatives that we would classify as egalitarian, or measures that win resources, rights, and protections for marginalized, poor, and working-class people, 60% of those pass, or they pass at a 60% rate, I should say. And that's significantly higher than the average initiative, which hovers around 50% pass rate. And for the subgroup that we classify as economically redistributive, or measures that keep wealth in the hands of poor and working communities, 75% pass during that decade. And that's actually a low estimate for a lot of places, because California is kind of an outlier. California is weird for a lot of reasons. They have a lot of initiatives, and they have this really convoluted system. Without California, redistributive measures pass almost 85% of the time in red and blue states alike. Right. So go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. I was just saying, I mean, it just is one of those things that's certainly interesting. And like, particularly for us here at Left Reckoning, where we like mainly focus on places like my home state of Texas, states in the South, when it comes to elections, there's a lot of other factors that go into, like, if you vote Republican or Democrat. But when it comes down to a lot of these policies, I think a lot of people have been very, surprised and pleasantly surprised to see the direction that people will go if you just ask them a straight up question, like, do you want your schools funded? Do you want to expand Medicaid? Things like that.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most important things about these campaigns, is that it shows that, we know that partisan politics is polarizing. We know everybody hates each other, and both party leadership, catastrophizes the other party. And that's not to say that all those arguments are wrong, but it makes us feel as though actually we don't agree on anything. And that's not true. Super majorities agree on all kinds of things that would be considered unrealistically progressive through partisan politics, right? I mean, minimum wage increases are the gold standard. Right. In the past quarter century, there have been 25 state level initiatives to raise the minimum wage, and every single one of them has passed with an average 60% of the vote. Every single one. I mean, the federal government hasn't raised the minimum wage since 2008, since before the Obama presidency. But when this question is, and again, this happens in red, blue, and purple states, these initiatives win. If you ask working people, do you think you should get paid more? People say yes.
You know, I don't mean to focus on it too much, but, you know, one of the things is like ballot initiatives are like unique to certain states. Like here you can do a constitutional amendment, but it's a long process, has to go through the ledge. But I'm just curious, as somebody who's been studying this for a while, I mean, from my understanding, a lot of these ballot initiatives in states, particularly in the West, like came out of these kind of populist demands in the first place. Is that a mistaken understanding?
No, that's absolutely right. And so ballot initiatives were introduced to the U.S. by the People's Party, which sometimes called the populists, in the late 19th century. And, you know, they were a multiracial coalition of farmers and workers in the Midwest and the South who saw ballot initiatives as one way to get around the, you know, the two-party system, which they saw as being captured by elites. And specifically, like agricultural corporations and railroad companies. You know, not a lot has changed, apparently, and big banks. And so they, you know, they saw ballot initiatives as a way that they could use majority opinion in those places to circumnavigate this system that was stacked against them. They used it for those purposes early on. A lot of the early initiatives were, I mean, you know, initiatives can have gone both ways. We would consider left and right, but a lot of the early initiatives were pro-labor, a lot of them enfranchised women. And then very quickly we saw all this pushback. We saw state legislatures trying to undermine them, trying to get rid of them, and stemming the tide of states adopting them. So until today, as you pointed out, only half the states have initiatives at the state level. And one of the things that I think makes them so challenging is that every state has different laws and different specifics around them, right? So for some states, you can do statutes but not amendments. Some states, amendments but not statutes. Some states, both. Some states, you can pass it, but it goes to the legislature first. You know, there's all these different specifics. But yeah, only half the states have them, and but a lot more municipalities have them as well at the local level. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the differences in law makes them difficult to approach. But no, you're absolutely right that they were introduced specifically as a means to get around an elite captured two-party system.
So, I mean, I want to talk about some of the, you know, the hurdles. I'm sure you're familiar, for example, with what happened in Idaho. Like my good friend and teacher, Luke Mayville, has really spearheaded, you know, a lot of these fights in Idaho to do things like Medicaid expansion. But of course, you then have to deal with the government when you get at that end. But we'll get to that in just a second. I want to ask you, like, so there's a viability to this kind of politics in the sense of, you know, we can put things to the people and sort of get them done. But you wrote in your piece in Jackman, and there's links below for people to read these, that the value of initiatives for those on the left is not the creation of a more authentic politics. And I was just curious if you could, you know, expand on that a little bit for our audience here.
Yeah, totally. I think this is really important because ballot initiatives can be a path to pass these some really important policies, but it's still part of the same political system. Right. Some people like to talk about ballot initiatives in this utopian light. Some people like to call them direct democracy. And so, you know, we should be clear that direct vote for a policy is different than voting for a representative to go make decisions on your behalf. That's true. But it's not participatory democracy, right? You know, this isn't ancient Athens. Even ancient Athens wasn't ancient Athens. You know what I mean? Like, people like to forget about the whole slavery of that situation. But, you know, this isn't town hall. This isn't general assemblies debating and deciding proposals together. You know, ballot initiatives are very expensive. They're often run by teams of professionals, you know, surrounded by the nonprofit industrial complex, by, you know, for-profit consultants and signature gathering firms, lobbyists, lawyers, all kinds of folks surround the ballot initiative process. They're, you know, one-time up or down votes, usually at the end of a long ballot, based on preset language that sometimes the campaigns themselves don't even get to have the final say in. You know, so again, ballot initiatives take place in a deeply compromised political system. So I guess we could say that ballot initiatives are like a different playbook. They're not a different sport, right?
And, No, I mean, and like one of the think, you know, major challenges too that you see, like just here in Austin, you know, we've used like city level referendums for a few things, mainly regarding like policing and different kinds of bonds. And like one thing that's really difficult too is like maintaining coalitions throughout, right? So you've seen sort of back and forth, right, to doing things like cutting police budgets, but then having like one of the strictest anti-homeless laws put on the books, you know, just a couple of years later, right? Like all of these kind of things make it difficult. It's like you can, you know, maybe get a coalition to win on one issue at one specific election, and then, you know, a year later, that coalition has sort of dissipated because it's different from even building like a campaign against, sorry, around a candidate. Those kind of connections, from my understanding.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, ballot campaigns, I mean, the more that you're messing with the rich people's money, really, and the more you're messing with decision-making power of politicians, the more you're going to face concerted efforts of corporate interests and the legislature and the judiciary. And what that means is that you not only have to get your initiative on the ballot, and you not only have to get a majority to vote for it, you also have to defend its implementation on the other side. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, those sorts of coalitions being durable would really matter. And we've seen a lot of really what would be, you know, potentially really effective measures fall apart on the other side. I mean, there was one in Arizona, you know, where the center's based, this really exciting initiative in 2020 that came on the heels of the Red for Ed teacher strikes to fund public schools, to tax the wealthy to fund public schools. Arizona has some of the worst funding for public schools in the country. The measure passed, but then the legislature dropped down the tax brackets to gut its effects. And then the year after that, the judiciary ruled it unconstitutional. So the ultimate effect was actually lower taxes for the rich. And you know, this initiative just went away. All the effort, all the, you know, the resources that went into that just went away, and that's really demoralizing and demobilizing. So you know, the more that these are really taking a bite into the way things are run, the more they're going to face these concerted efforts against them, and the more it's going to take coalitions and also, you know, likely actions outside of the election process to defend them.
So, I mean, I want to talk about something specific about ballot language in a second, but just while we're on this, I mean, yeah, this is the other kind of tension with ballot initiatives. Is like, one, if you don't control the institutions that are implementing these things, then you have fights. Like this has been what's happening in Idaho. Then you have judicial challenges where, you know, redistricting or things like that. Every state's different, but I believe in Idaho and I think in Tennessee too, there were funny things where districts were changing and then, you know, signatures were sort of being invalidated because of it. I mean, could you talk a little bit about some of these direct hurdles? You know, one from the judicial side, the legislative side, and then the financial side as well to ballot initiatives for progressives and the left.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think one of the important things to understand about opposition to initiatives, not just individual initiatives, but the initiative process in a lot of these states, is that it's a mix of legislative, judicial, and money being put against them. And I think the best example of all three of those coming together is in Mississippi, where in 2020, they passed medical marijuana legalization through ballot initiative. And, you know, there was money put toward a lawsuit to challenge it. And the lawsuit challenged it on the basis that in Mississippi state constitution as of 1992, it said that in order to get an initiative on the ballot, you had to gather signatures from all five congressional districts in Mississippi. But since then, Mississippi was reduced to four congressional districts. So they challenged it on this technicality that, well, they didn't gather it from five, they gathered it from four. But there are only four. The judiciary sided with the plaintiff, effectively removing ballots from the law book, saying it's not possible to get an initiative on the ballot, right? I mean, this is like something that's straight out of Catch-22. So, you know, the legislature then steps in and says, well, okay, we're going to play the good guys. Like, we have to write a new version of ballot initiative law. But of course, the new version now has legislative oversight. So you can see the way that all these forces kind of combine to undermine the power of the initiative in Mississippi. But we see, you know, we see similar things in other states as well. I mean, you know, in a lot of states, as you mentioned, signatures can be challenged for all kinds of reasons. you know, I was talking to folks in Arizona who had an initiative thrown off the ballot this past year, which was supposed to defend voting rights. And, you know, they can nitpick these signatures for all kinds of frankly, absurd reasons. I mean, throwing things off the ballot because they're, you know, the notary stamp is slightly faded and one letter is not fully visible, for example, or the person gathering the signatures, you know, signed or, you know, signed in one place, but they're supposed to sign in two places. And if they missed one, all the signatures they gathered can be thrown out. So things like that, where, you know, you're gathering all these signatures, now you know on the front end you have to gather that many more because you're going to face all these challenges, right? And that often means paying for signatures, right? Which that's going to increase the costs of the campaign. You know, then they can subpoena signature gatherers who are paid to show up in court, right? That's going to increase your costs again. And if they can't show up in court on short notice, their signatures can be invalidated. So it's all these sorts of ways where it's like the death by a thousand paper cuts, where they can chip away in all these ways, and the overall effect is making initiatives more expensive, less accessible, and less able to actually make the changes people need.
So on that, I mean, you know, sometimes you get this from like the Vox crowd out there, that they don't like things like ballot initiatives, particularly on the city level, because the way that these things are written sometimes can be very unclear and you can end up getting like unintended policy outcomes. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that argument. And second, like, you know, in the Kansas example, I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting about it was like what was actually voted on the text there was incredibly confusing. And I think we've seen it be sort of shown that no, like abortion rights are like fairly popular, even in quote unquote red states across the board. But you know, there is this kind of, you know, slippage or like danger here of people, you know, being invited to vote on something to make a decision, not really understanding it. I mean, I'll just say, you know, here in Texas, we always have these really wild, constitutional amendments. And we have a big ballot, you know, I have to come in with my cheat sheet. I study politics for a living. And sometimes, you know, when I'm voting on this thing, I'm like trying to remember, it's like, wait, is this the kind of thing that's going to make us have to pray in schools or not pray in schools? Because it's written in a very, very convoluted and confusing way. And I'm just curious, as somebody who's been studying this for a while, what your thoughts are on those issues as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the first thing I would say, though, is we have to remember that there's a difference between citizen initiatives and legislative initiatives. And terminology is a big problem here because people use all the words for all the things. So people call both of them ballot initiatives. Sometimes people call both of them referendums. Sometimes people call it propositions or questions. But whatever terminology we use, I use, so for example, citizen initiatives are when citizen, non-elected citizens gather signatures on a petition. You gather a certain amount of signatures. Usually it's a percentage of the previous gubernatorial or presidential election in the state. And then you get that question put to other voters, right? There's then legislative initiatives, which I call referendums. And I'm not just pulling that out of nowhere. A lot of people call them referendums. But again, it's confusing because some people use referendums for both. But legislative referendums are when elected representatives choose to put a question to voters. Sometimes that's mandated in order, for example, to pass a constitutional amendment. Some states, they make you put it to voters. But Texas is an example where all the initiatives you see are gonna be legislatively referred. There's no citizen initiatives there. And sometimes I think legislators will write these things to be confusing on purpose, either because they want people to be confused and vote against them, or because they want, you know, in the case of Kansas, a lot of the, you know, some of the activists there thought that, you know, they were writing it in a way that the folks who wanted to get rid of abortion would understand it. Maybe a few of the folks who wanted to defend abortion might misunderstand what they were voting for and vote the opposite way. So sometimes these things are done like that on purpose. In other states where there's citizen initiatives, sometimes the campaign doesn't have final say over the wording. So maybe the attorney general might have the final say. If the attorney general is hostile to the policy, they might write it to be convoluted on purpose, again, in order to confuse people or upset people, you know, include the word taxes for no reason to scare people away or things like that. I feel like there's a second part to your question that I can't remember now.
I mean, the other one was a kind of more technocrat criticism that like these end up creating bad policy because people from the outside don't understand the inner workings of the government. So they're just going to, you know, ask for something that's going to be impossible to implement or something that when it's implemented will have like the opposite of the intended effect.
Yeah, I absolutely think that that's the case a lot of times. I mean, that's mm-hmm. certainly a problem. I think what's important to remember, though, is that we're assessing whether or not to use ballot initiatives as a tool in the political system as it exists now. Mm-hmm. If we're debating in theory, like if we're playing like Sim Society and we're trying to create a political system from scratch, then we might talk in theory about what makes more sense, you know, representative democracy or direct democracy or whatever. But in our case, we're talking about a system where the legislature is not passing, you know, nationally or almost in any case statewide, is not passing policies that working people need. Mm-hmm. So in that context, we don't have a seat at that table. Even when we elect representatives that we like and we trust, even when we're able to do that, we have no access to legislative majorities. Mm-hmm. So we just don't have a seat at that table. This is the only option we have through the mechanisms of state politics as they exist. This is the only access we have to passing the policies we need. So it's not about it being a perfect system. It's not perfect. There's probably a lot of ways it could be improved, but it exists within a constellation of forces that are trying to undermine these policies as we pass them. But this is the avenue we have. So for me, the question is more about how do we use these as effectively as possible?
Well, then, I mean, in closing, you know, we have a lot of listeners all across the country. You know, we see that there's some of the hurdles, which we were just going through. But I think most people listening to this program already have this kind of recognition that, yeah, like the system that we have right now is not working in the sense of our government sort of reflecting popular will, if you want to use that kind of charged term on a lot of these major issues. So, you know, how should people on the left and progressives think about using you know, ballot initiatives in the near term. And then maybe if you feel like it, you know, attaching a kind of longer view about how we can maybe use these to try to spur up movements and mobilizations that can sort of get at some of the underlying issues as to why our democracy is so unrepresentative right now.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a tool, right? Mm-hmm. It's a tool we have in the toolbox, and it's a tool that I think the left has neglected for a really long time. It's certainly not the only tool, and we'd be, you know, we'd be really mistaken if we put too many eggs in that basket. But I do think it's an important tool to consider. You know, maybe the policy that you need to get passed, is not good for ballot initiatives. Maybe you want more complex or more systemic change that a ballot initiative is not going to help. But maybe there's a way that either a municipal level or a state level initiative might be able to reinforce your struggle. I mean, for example, there's people I know at the municipal level. There was a bunch of, I think there were 11 in New York and California transfer taxes run at municipal levels. It seems pretty wonky, but this is something where you can tax sales of wealthy homes to fund, you know, in this case, to fund housing for people without homes or for public education or things like that, that might help reinforce other things you're doing. They're only good for some things, you know, the simpler, the better for them. They're not good for very complex things. But, you know, they are a method of achieving some tangible policy wins that aren't possible through other means. And so it's something that I think that, that folks who are involved in organizing campaigns, whether it's, you know, community-based or labor-based or whatever it may be, it's something to consider. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I think that it's important that we pay attention to them because they highlight the disconnect between the representative system and popular will, as you put it. They highlight the way that the representative system is not representing, it's not set up to represent the popular will. We see that when we see legislators try to undermine the vote of people from their own party when they go to pass something in that state, right? So that's important to focus on. I think that's important for consciousness raising in general. And finally, I think ballot campaigns, you know, I think they can provide a basis to speak to people across party lines. And we're going to have to do that one way or another. If we're going to, you know, if we're going to win things like a livable society, you know, if we can imagine something like that, we're going to need to talk to people across party lines. And the partisan system is set up with this map, but there's red and blue states, and, you know, we're not supposed to talk to the other people. The other people are you know, incorrigible and like maybe evil. And so, and we can't talk to them. We talk to our own people. We stay in our bubble. But you know, ballot initiatives let us talk to people about specific policies. We can put all that aside for a moment. And like, can we agree on the fact that like people should have medical care? Can we agree on the fact that like, you know, predatory debt collection is wrong? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Can we agree that people should be paid more? Can we agree on some of these things? And, you know, yeah, so that's a method potentially for passing some of these policies, but it's also a way to start that conversation. And so, you know, maybe if we're thinking optimistically, maybe that's one step on a path to building a class politics in this country.
I mean, I totally agree. And particularly, you know, somebody from here, from Texas, like, I think it's always important to be able to talk to your neighbors and people in your community. And you realize that, you know, we really do actually have like a minoritarian government. Some of the things Ground Game Texas here did a lot of really great ballot initiatives on the city level, or citizen initiatives on the city level to decriminalize marijuana. Huge, you know, something that seems absolutely impossible to do in the legislative level. So I definitely appreciate your work on this and your perspective so much. Ben Case is a postdoctoral scholar at the Center for Work and Democracy at Arizona State University. I will have links below for ways to check out more of their work, and really do appreciate your time so much.
Yes, folks. David and I will see you in the post game. We'll be live in, I would imagine, 10 minutes or so, and we'll be having fun with Benjamin Netanyahu. Which is, yeah. And I'll be getting to your call. So, let me put up the number for y'all. Where is that at? How do I do that? Yes, boom. Leave us a message, 1-940-289-7234. And we'll get to it in the post game. Actually, I think David's going to see us. He'll say goodbye here, too, in a second. And he's muted, but you can just imagine.
We're just pros over here. sorry. I know you're just teasing the post game, so be sure to join us over there. And I just want to say, like, very thankful for Ben and Kurt coming on the show. Be sure to check out the show notes below for links to follow all the work that they've been doing.
Peace.